Let's begin now with our Maima. Now, this Maima is on Shabbat Pashat. It was originally said Shabbat Pashat Mishpatim, which was in it was said in Tavshin Mem Aleph 5741, which was 1981. And this week's parsha is Mishpatim, about the laws. Last week we had Yitro, where we have the giving of the Ten Commandments, and this week the Torah presents the some of the laws of the Torah. And it's interesting what kind of selection of laws, which tend to be, for the most part, in Mishpatim, they are civil law. They are laws concerning practical relationships between people, what happens if someone digs a pit and someone's animal falls into the pit and gets killed or damaged, or other similar kinds of issues, lending something to someone or asking someone to look after something for you and it gets spoiled, it gets stolen, did the person look after it properly? That's the kind of law which is in Mishpatim. But in fact, Mishpatim begins with a different topic, also civil practical law. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. These are the laws you should put before them. Now, this idea of putting before them, this is something emphasized in the Talmud, and Rashi quotes it, that tasim nifnehem means you not just put it before them, really teach the person, that they really understand it. It's not just enough to repeat it to them so that they know it parrot fashion. They really have to understand it. And what it then speaks about is ki tikneh eved ivri. When you acquire a Hebrew servant, a Hebrew slave, Sheish shanim ya'avod, he should work for 6 years, uvashvi'it yetzei lachofshi chinam, and the seventh year he goes out free, without him having to pay anything. You have acquired him as a slave, and he's a slave for 6 years, and then the seventh he goes free. Now, that's about the Hebrew slave there. On the other side of the page, a few lines later, it also talks about Pasuk 7. V'chi yimko ishet bito la'ama. When a man sells his daughter as a maidservant. Now, she has a slightly different rule. In fact, she is supposed to, ideally, she's supposed to marry either the master that she's been sold to or his son. And if not, when she reaches puberty, she has to go free. So there is the Hebrew slave, there is the Hebrew maidservant, and there's also a Canaanite slave. The Canaanite slave in this verse 7, V'chiyim ko'eshet bito la'ama, lo tetze ketzeta avadim, she doesn't go out like the Canaanite slave would go out. Now, the Canaanite slave goes out under certain circumstances. For example, if his master hit him and knocked out one of his teeth or an eye, then the Canaanite slave goes out free. Yeah, of course. But of course, so these. It's an intriguing thing, given that we had the giving of the Torah last week.
Does that mean that the master can beat up a Jewish slave if he likes for 6 years?
If he beats up the Jewish slave, then the Jewish slave can sue him, and with his track Jewish lawyer and get damages from him. Jewish haiku. Lying in the road, wondering who to sue.
That's wonderful.
Now, So this is the context, as it were, for this particular discourse. However, the discourse actually, although it doesn't follow it in time in terms of when the discourses were said, but it's fairly easy to understand why it should follow in subject. Last week we explored a very, very interesting concept of the whole nature of the giving of the Torah and the way in which the giving of the Torah is a continuous process. And just as the existence of the world is a kind of continuous flow of godliness coming into the world and making it exist, so is the giving of the Torah a continuous flow of Torah teaching coming into the world, extending through the expounders of the Torah through the generations, that in each case it is a kind of continuation of the giving of the Torah at the very beginning. And last week we looked at it. It wasn't actually in the discourse, but it was from another talk by the Rebbe, which spoke about the idea which is in the Talmud Yerushalmi and elsewhere as well, that kol ma shetalmid vatik, everything that a seasoned student, atid lechadesh bifnei rabo, will say as a chidush, as a new idea in discussion with his teacher, kvar ne'emar leMoshe b'Sinai, was already told to Moses on Mount Sinai. So last week's theme was about the continuous process of the giving of the Torah. Now, this week, the Maimer, the discourse that we're exploring this week, concerns the continuous power of the relationship of the individual studying Torah, and the way in which the study of Torah is a tremendous transaction with the infinite, with Ein Sof. And the verse that we have spoken about, this idea of the laws which you put before them, which you should teach people, and about the Hebrew slave, the whole verse is interpreted in terms of the transmission and the teaching of Torah, and the idea of a slave, whether it's a Hebrew slave or a Canaanite slave or a maidservant, are all understood in terms of the relationship of the individual with the divine. And of those three, which one do you think is the tzaddik? Which one do you think is the highest level in relationship with the divine? Canaanite slave, Hebrew slave, maidservant.
Maidservant.
Quite right, Dulit. Well done. Absolutely right. The maidservant, the Amaha Ivriyah, she represents the tzaddik. That's a quality of total bonding with godliness. At a lower level is the Hebrew slave, who has positive desires. And further down is the Canaanite slave, which actually represents most of us. But there are certain qualities within the Canaanite slave which are themselves very positive. But the Hebrew slave is the one who has, he is a slave. And the interesting thing, I mean, when it discusses, it's a very long discourse, so we're not going to be able to cover everything word for word. But when it talks about the Canaanite slave only acts because it's going to be hit by this, by a shevet, by a rod, if it doesn't do what it's being told to do. And that is us, most of us. We won't do anything unless the divine soul illuminates us. That's the rod. That's the stick which bangs us.
If he ducks and the rod hits his tooth, then he can go free.
Well, the discourse doesn't explore that possibility, but maybe what that means is he turns into a different level. Instead of being a Canaanite slave, becomes a Hebrew slave, where, you see, the Canaanite slave is
seen, way of conversion.
The Canaanite slave is seen as a slothful slave. Avda behefkeira nichale, a slave likes doing nothing. that unless he's forced to, he won't do anything. And what forces him? The prompting of the divine soul. That's what prompts him. But the Hebrew slave actually enjoys it. Yes, he's a slave. Yes, he is forced to do these things, but he gets tremendous ta'anug out of doing them. And it comes out that that's why this parsha begins with the Hebrew slave, because we're talking about keeping Hashem's laws, but keeping them not only with Kabbalat Ol, acceptance of the yoke, which is the concept of being a slave to God, that we have to keep Hashem's laws, but also enjoying the laws that we are given. And but first of all, it talks about, before it gets into the slave, it talks about Hamishpatim, the laws, Asher Tassim Lifnehem, which you should put before them, and we're going to see various aspects of that. So in order for us to wriggle into the luminous domain of the discourse, we will sing the Maimah melody. Oh, yo, 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 Aho ya yedam ba ya ya yo ya yedam ba ya ya yom ha yedam ba ha yedam ba ho ya ya yam ba ya 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 yam ba ya yam ba ya 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 yam ho ya ya yo ya ya yom ve'eila hamishpatim asher tasim lifneihem, and these are the laws which you should put before them. So this is coming straight after Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah to Moshe and the Jewish people, when we heard the Ten Commandments. Ki tikne eved ivri, when you buy a Hebrew slave. V'yadua hadiyuk v'zeh, the Rebbe says in the Maima, in the discourse, it's known, the question that's asked about this. The lifnehem, the word lifnehem, these are the laws you should put before them. Hulushon rabim, it's in the plural. Hulushon nistar, and it's in the third person. You should put before them. V'tikne, ki tikne, when you buy, when you acquire a Hebrew slave, hulushon yachid, is in the singular, v'lushon nochach, and it's in the second person. So that's one point, the change from the third person to the second. Gam tzarich lahavin, we also have to understand, ma'aditab Yerushalmi, what we learn in the Talmud Yerushalmi, ala pasuk ve'eila hamishpatim asher tasim lifneim, on this verse, these are the laws you should put before them, the tasim hum l'shon sima, otzar, that the word tasim is related to the word sima with a samach instead of a sin, and that means a treasure, she'eino niglet, something not revealed, razei Torah, secrets of Torah, mysteries of Torah. It's interesting, the Talmud Yerushalmi there says that you should be careful who you teach Torah to, because the Torah is really secrets. It's really sima. It's really an otzar. It's a treasure. It's a spiritual treasure. And here we've got this concept that, in fact, what we are talking about is teaching and transmitting to someone spiritual razei Torah, secrets of Torah. But tzarich lahavin, we have to understand. Harei mishpatim heim hadinim shemuvanim gam basechel enoshi. The word mishpatim, we talk about different categories of Jewish law. Chukim, ediyot, and mishpatim. Chukim are statutes, like not to eat milk and meat together. Doesn't have any obvious reason. And also, it's not something that anyone else, apart, maybe some tribe somewhere, but it's not something other people say. Oh yes, you shouldn't eat milk and meat together. It's a Jewish concept, and it doesn't have any obvious reason. Ediyot are testimonies, like for example Pesach, celebrating going out of Egypt. So although the details of Pesach, how exactly we keep it, they are in fact chukim, but the general concept of having a ceremony to remember something that happened, a crucial event in one's history, that's understandable. And mishpatim are laws, which every country has laws. Every people has laws, including about slaves in the time of the Torah. Other countries also, other peoples also had slaves, and they had rules about how you conduct yourself with slaves. And the other laws which are in Mishpatim about lending someone something and about damage caused by your property to someone else, well, every society has some kind of regulatory laws. So Mishpatim are something understood by human intellect, va'afilu b'seichel du'umot ha'olam, including the intellect of the nations of the world. Maya shaychut de Mishpatim, how do you connect these sort of rather practical social contract kind of laws, l'tasim l'shon sima razei Torah, to the idea via the Jerusalem Talmud passage of secrets of Torah, right? Tasim, which means put, which is understood as teach, and is connected in the Jerusalem Talmud to the word treasure, which then comes not just treasure, it's esoteric treasure, secrets of Torah. Gam tzarich lavin, we also have to understand, ma shematchila mishpatim bedin eved ivri. Why, among all these laws, does it begin with the law of the Hebrew slave? Okay, section 2. Vehine mevua bo'or ha-Torah. Now it's explained in the book O HaTorah, which is a wonderful book. I'll tell you why it's wonderful, because it's got many volumes. I mean, there are many. It's the Or HaTorah was the manuscript nachlas, the manuscript legacy of the Rebbe, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, who lived in the middle of the 19th century, around 1850, called the Tzemach Tzedek, Rebbe Nachmendel the Tzemach Tzedek. The name, the Tzemach Tzedek, is the name of his responsa, Shailot Tshuvot, which were published in about six large volumes, am I right, shortly after he passed away. And he's well known as Posek Halacha. He was particularly famous in his lifetime for dealing with the problems of an issue that is very much of concern today as well, Agunot. And from all over Russia and the Jewish world in general, in Eastern Europe, possibly even further afield, Agunot would come to the Tzemach Tzedek and explain their situation to him and try to find a way. And he wrote many tshuvot about Agunot trying to solve the problem, which sometimes he was able to, you know, I think quite a lot. You know, he represents the trend. I don't think he was the only rabbi of that time doing this. But there was a trend to try to find as many kulot as possible, as much leniency as possible, in order to solve the tragic situation of Agunot. And So he did this in a very masterly way, writing very long, complex discussions of all the Talmudic issues involved, and not always was he able to solve the problem, but he very often did succeed on a halachic level. So the point is that apart from his halachic writings, he also left about 50 volumes of manuscript, of which was then published in 40 printed volumes of Hasidic teachings. So they go under the generic name Or HaTorah, the light of the Torah. So he writes there, it explains in Or HaTorah, this, the Hasidic teachings of the Tzemach Tzedek, the Inyan Eved Ivri Baruch Niyot Hu, the idea of the Hebrew slave spiritually is, Sha'avodato et Hashemi bederech kabalat ol, that the way this slave serves God is with acceptance of the yoke, avodat eved, the service of a slave. Va'al pizeh, and according, now, eventually, towards the end of the discourse, it explains that it's not just with acceptance of the yoke, it's with joy and ta'anug as well. And that's the difference between the Eved Ivri and the Eved Kanani. So the Eved Ivri is one who serves God with acceptance of the yoke, but there is a ta'anug as well. Va'al pizeh yesh lomar, according to this one can say, dezeh she'atchalat ha'mishpatim hu b'din Eved Ivri, the idea that the beginning of Mishpatim in our parsha is with the law of the Hebrew slave, who l'ramez is to hint to us, shegam kiyum ha'mitzvot d'mishpatim, that also the observance of the simple laws, the social contract type of laws, shehem muvanim baseichel, which can be understood by human intellect, by ordinary rational intellect, tzarich lekaimam mitzad kabbalat ol, one has to keep them not only because it's a social contract, but also with acceptance of the yoke b'derech avodat eved, in the way that a slave serves its master, that it's told, this is how you should do it. So therefore, although these are rational, we should also understand that they are divine as well. Now, the whole focus of this discourse is about the combination of rationality and our own personal understanding of Torah, the way in which we make the Torah ours, Torato, the Torah of the person, and our, as it were, empowerment in relation to the Torah, contrasting with the divine suprarational aspect of the Torah, and the idea that these two can be brought together and focused together through the power of Ein Sof, of the infinite. So there is the spiritual dimension of the Torah beyond reason. There is the rational level of the Torah within the reason of the, within the intellect of the person studying the Torah. And beyond is Ein Sof, which affects this bond. Because Ein Sof, because the infinite is beyond limitations, it's able to bind together selflessness, bitul, acceptance of the yoke, self-abnegation, together with rational understanding. And the final point that the discourse makes is that through this process, the Ein Sof, the infinite, is revealed in an amazing way through our rational and empowered understanding of the Torah. So that would all make quite an attractive diagram. So maybe let's see if we can represent that. So if we take blue to represent the infinite, okay, Ein Sof. So that's the quality of Ein Sof, which is really achieving this bond. And we then have Torato, the Torah of the person. Now, the Torah of the person is the point where we understand Torah, we write books about Torah, we give talks about Torah. That's where the Torah is internalized in various ways. We make chidushim, we make new suggestions, new ideas. Then we have a higher level of Torah, we would think, Torah Hashem, Torah of God, Torah of Hashem, which is on a higher spiritual level beyond rationality. Yes, I mean, if we were to assume that there is a kind of a line of reason. The line of reason would be here in the middle, and the Torah of Hashem is higher. Beyond that, the Torah of the person is lower. But we are talking about joining together the Torah of the person with the Torah of Hashem through the power of Ein Sof. The infinite is able to put these two together. And even more than that, that's how the infinite is actually revealed, through the fact that the person acquires this Torah Hashem and then communicates Torah, studies Torah, thinks about Torah, maybe writes a footnote in his or in his little notebook when he's learning Gemara. You know, he writes his little comments on what the Talmud is saying and what Rashi and Tosfot, and then he writes his own little addition in his notebook, which, as with, I don't know. So then he puts it on his blog.
And where does
his grandson puts it, his granddaughter puts it on his blog.
Where does this appear so far in the Maimon?
It's going to be later on.
Not yet.
Not yet, no. No,
so they missed it.
No, for some... No, I mean, my...
telling us this just in case we don't get to the paper.
Yeah, and it also helps us understand the ideas.
Where it's going.
Yeah, because there's a sense in which you can't understand a Maimah if you learn it once. You have to learn a Maimah several times, because then you know the constructs which are there at the end, and they help you understand what the beginning is saying. So, Reb Mendel Fudafas used to tell me, he was this great chassid, there's a picture of him over there. He used to talk about learning the same Maimah every single day for a year, 2 years. And he said every day you discover something new in the same Maimah. He would learn it as a preparation for prayer. And so by giving some idea of what's ahead, I'm hoping that that will help us understand it at this point. Okay. So that is the idea that the Mishpatim, which are rational, so to speak, rational mitzvot, we also have to realize that they have a spiritual dimension as well, that they are beyond reason. They are mitzvot which come from infinite God on Mount Sinai. So it's not just a matter of the social contract. Yes, the social contract theory is that when you have a group of people living together, so they agree, well, let's not steal from each other because that will upset us, so we'll agree not to steal and we won't do this, and if someone digs a pit in the road and someone else falls into it or something, we agree that they have to pay compensation, something like that. Whereas here, the same kind of laws have the imprint of divine as well. Incidentally, the rational laws of society as a whole also have a certain relationship with the seven Noahide laws, which themselves come from God as well. You know, that's a question that this discourse doesn't address at this point, but if one were looking at the concept of law and society, one would have to also consider that no law is just social contract. There is a further dimension in all law. But that's for another discussion. Even though these mitzvot, these laws, are called in the Torah of truth, b'shem mishpatim, they are called laws, understandable laws, unlike chukim, which are not understandable laws, statutes. Muvan, it's understood, shemitzvot eila, we understand that these laws, sarich lekaimen gam mitzad atam. In other words, the Torah calls these rational laws, so we have to appreciate the reason in them. We can't just say these are the irrational, inscrutable laws of God. We have to understand that they have a rationality, and we have to explore that rationality. And in the Talmud, when it discusses the practicalities of Jewish law, it very much is investigating it in terms of what people think and what people expect. And if a person says, I'm going to sell you a house, do they mean the garden of the house as well? And if they mean the garden of the house, do they mean the well which is in front of the house? So what is intended and what is understood by people? You know, so if you bought the house, then they told you, oh, we didn't mean the garden. You know, so you may have a claim against the seller. I thought I was buying the house and the garden. Mikol makom, nonetheless, even though indeed these mishpatim, see, I'm putting it over here as the you know, the laws of the person, which is where we eventually end up. So let's just write rational law. Rational law, and this, here we are, color coded in red, law beyond reason. Okay? Law beyond reason. This is a constant interplay in Chabad thought. Reason and beyond reason. I actually once wrote an article, Reason and Beyond Reason, in Chabad Hasidism. So it's the so there's a constant interplay, because on the one hand, Chabad, Chochmah, Binah, Da'at, wisdom, understanding, knowledge, is seeking to use the faculty of reason within a person. But it's seeking to reach beyond reason and draw the beyond reason into the reason and connect the two. This was not always understood by other Hasidic leaders. There were Hasidic leaders, contemporaries of Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad, who could not understand this rationality. They said, the spiritual is beyond reason, full stop. Don't try to give any rational explanations. You're talking philosophy. That was what Reb Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichov said about a famous Hasidic Rebbe. He wrote a book called Sumirav Asitoiv, translated by Louis Jacobs, incidentally. So Reb Tzvi Hirsch called the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Dovber, a philosopher, because which was a negative description in Eastern Europe. At that point, because he said spirituality has to be beyond, in the realm beyond, whereas the Chabad thrust is to bring that which is beyond into the realm of rationality, and then you go further beyond. You don't stop there. You go further beyond. There's always a level which is beyond. Okay, so here we have the idea that there are both aspects, that there is the idea of understanding these laws, the rational laws, and we understand them and discuss them and analyze them, and mikol makom, ikar kiyumam tzarich liot bederech kabbalat ol, the main way of keeping these laws should be in a way of acceptance of the yoke. Hein mitzad ha'adam ha'makayim et ha'mitzvot, whether we're talking about the person who's keeping the mitzvot, shekiyum ha'mitzvot shelo tzarich liot bederech avodat eved, that the way he keeps them should be as a slave, does what his master tells him, v'gam matzad ha'mitzvot, and also regarding the mitzvot themselves, kichol ha'mitzvot, gam ha'mitzvot ha'mishpatim, because all the mitzvot, including these, so to speak, rational laws, ikram hu, the main aspect about them is, sheheim rotzon ha'kadosh baruch hu, they are the will of God. Rotzon shalamayle mitam, will which is above reason. Eile shekach gaza ha'kadosh baruch hu, but God decreed, Shaharatzon the mitzvot elum, that the will, the supernal will beyond reason of these laws, yitlabesh gambatam, should also be expressed in reason as well. So there should also be the rational dimension. Olahosif monkanat, the zeh shegam kiyumam mitzvot the mishpatim tzarich liot bederech kabbalat ol. The fact that the keeping of the mitzvot, of these rational laws, has to be in a way of acceptance of the yoke, as if they were irrational, also relates to the very rationality of them. The idea of keeping these mitzvot also because they make sense rationally, that itself is a divine decree. So the ability to see them as a rational construct is itself part of an irrational divine decree. Because that is the decree of God, that the keeping of these mitzvot should also be because of reason. There's an interesting footnote here, footnote 13. Let's try and understand this footnote. In this, there are also the two ideas. Ki Yisrael heim avadim laKadosh Baruch Hu. The Jewish people are slaves, servants to God. The whole slave and everything about him, including his mind, not only his power of action, but also his intellect, mushubadim laAdon, are subject to the master. The slave doesn't only have to be someone who sweeps the floor. You could have a slave who had to mix delicate paints for Egyptian hieroglyphics or something. That might have been a very, very clever slave that's with using great intellect in what it was doing. The very fact that a person contemplates in their mind the meaning of the mitzvah is because of the command of God. God is telling us, use your mind, think, what is the meaning of the mitzvah? And also as regards the mitzvah, that's the second side, there's the person and the mitzvah. The idea that the will of these mitzvot, of mishpatim, of these rational mitzvot, nitlabesh b'tam, the fact that it's actually expressed in a reason, or reasons, it's not because sharatzon the mitzvot elu, that the divine will infusing these mitzvot, hu b'dargan nemucha yoter, is on a lower level than meharatzon the chukim, than the will which goes into the statutes, which cannot be understood. Ela mipnei shekach gaza hakadosh baruch hu. But that was the decree of God that these mitzvot should be within the realm of rationality. So it's a subtle point, but it's a very interesting point. Now notice these two aspects, there's the mitzvah in itself and there's the person keeping the mitzvah. Now there is a famous analysis of the nature of Jewish law, analyzes it in terms of gavra and cheftza, the person and the object. So, for example, there's a law that one should put a mezuzah on the door. So there's two things. The person has a house which needs to have a mezuzah. So he gets a mezuzah and he puts the mezuzah on the door. Now the person lives in a house where a mezuzah is on the door. You can focus on the person. You can now look at it the other way around. Not at the person, gavra, but at the cheftza. You can say that here is a house which is owned by a Jew. Therefore, this house needs to have a mezuzah. Ah, here is a mezuzah being put on the door. Wonderful. Now the house has a mezuzah. So you can look at the whole thing where the center of attention is the object, is the house and the mezuzah. Or you can look at the whole thing from where the center of attention is the person who has got the law, has got the mitzvah that he should put a mezuzah on the door. Here it's slightly different. We're looking here at the person and the mitzvah. The person who's doing the mitzvah is one thing, and the analysis of the mitzvah is another thing. So the fact that the mitzvah as something in the Gemara which can be analyzed and thought about is like an, it's like a thing in itself. It's like a reality of its own. We're not talking about the effect of this mitzvah. You know, what do you do with the pit that you dug in the street? We're talking here about the discussion of the pit which you dug in the street, or which someone dug in the street. So, and then something fell into it. So, but that discussion and that analysis of this issue is like a thing in itself, and the person who is keeping the mitzvah is another issue. So that's the, it's a little bit ka'ein, it's similar to gavra v'cheftza, the person and the object, but here it's the person and the mitzvah, or the piece of Torah. Now, although it doesn't say this in the Maimon, when one studies Talmudic analysis of these mitzvot, in fact, there's a certain irrational dimension to them. So although the Talmud has its own rationality, it always seems to make certain steps which like seem beyond rational, you know, and that's the Talmudic way of analysis. And if one is exploring just with cold logic, one might well find that there are gaps in the argument. Whereas the Talmud has a way of putting things together which have a certain super rational... I mean, you could say, as in any rational system, the axioms, which are the underpinning of that system, are themselves beyond rational. The Rebbe discusses this in discussing the methodology of science, because there are certain axioms within any science, within any study, and the fact that those are the axioms, like the difference between Euclidean and non-Euclidean geometry, these are axioms. So on the one hand you have, I'm not quite sure what the defining axioms are, I think of it just in the simple terms. In Euclidean geometry, the three angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees, and in non-Euclidean geometry, they don't. So it's every year nine pupil in school knows the three angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees, and later on they discover, or maybe in year seven they discover that that's only Euclidean geometry, and in non-Euclidean geometry it's different. In other words, geometry on a sphere. If you draw the triangle on a sphere or inside a sphere, then the angles are of a different side. They add up to something different. So the point is that there is a supra-rational dimension to the rationality of these rational mitzvot as well. And that's the way that it's being connected together in this maima accords with the experience that a person has trying to learn Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, which are the sections of the Gemara which talk about these laws and get straight the Talmudic reasoning which is there. You know, so one needs the ability to appreciate something wider than the simple limitations of 2 plus 2 equals 4, therefore 4 plus 4 equals 8. It could be slightly different. Now, Vayeshloma. Now, see, there's another dimension of what is taking place here, is a linking together of different comments by the sages. So, for example, we have the comment of the Jerusalem Talmud, which relates the word tasim to a treasure. There is also actually unstated in the Maimah what Rashi says about tasim mean teaching and communicating, which comes from the Talmud itself. So that's underlying it. So there's a certain underlying field of discourse of Talmudic comments, Midrashic comments. And then there's another idea, another comment from the sages. It gives us the source from the Mechilta, right, which is a midrash, which is quoted in Rashi as well. So this is another passage from Rashi. V'yesh l'ma, and one can also suggest, zeh she'amru razal, that which the sages said ala pasuk, v'eile ha'mishpatim, and these are the laws. Now, the parsha begins, and these are the laws. The last line of the previous parsha is telling us that if you build an altar, when we build an altar, there should be a slope, because in some way a slope instead of steps, because steps have a certain immodest quality to them, whereas the slope is more modest. That's all about Mount Sinai and the whole revelation at Sinai and the last bits of law that were communicated there. And then Ve'ele HaMishpatim, and these are the laws you should teach them. So Rashi says, what does he say? Ve'ele Mosif al Harishonim, and these, in quotes, adds to the earlier laws. Ma Harishonim Misinai, just as the earlier laws were from Sinai. In other words, the Ten Commandments and these other laws, including building a slope for the altar, after Elu Misinai. So these laws also about the Hebrew slave and so on, they're also from Sinai. The Matan Torah, because at the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, Nasu Yisrael, Abadim LaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Jewish people became slaves to God. This is what the discourse here is adding to that idea. Because we became slaves to God, Vaharemez, Vaafelu Misinai Hu. That's what it means, that these laws are also from Sinai. Shagam kima mitzvot de mishpatim. That also the keeping of the rational laws, kol el gam inyan zeh, including this, this idea, shetzarich lekaiman gam mitzvot atam, that we have to keep them rationally understanding them. Af elu mishpatim, also these, this rationality, tzarich liot bederech avodat eved, has to be in the way of a slave, of someone who's been blown out of his mind receiving the Torah from Sinai. So in other words, in our rationality, we can also have the supra-rational meeting with God at Mount Sinai at every step of the way. Now last week, we had the idea that whenever a person studies Torah, God is saying those same words with him or her from Sinai. So the word in English for the revelation at Sinai is theophany, the revelation of God. So every time a person studies Torah, it's a theophany. When a phone goes off in the Beit HaMedrash and people are praying and then the phone rings like a mobile phone, I always say, look, they're getting a reply. So maybe there's a comment about the...
What does he say?
Okay. So, v'lachein, and therefore, hatchalat ha-mishpatim hu b'din eved ivri. That's why the first of the laws is with the Hebrew slave. B'chdei l'ramez, that liot shagam ha-mitzvot de-mishpatim, that also the rational laws, the rational concept, ha-gisha ha-rishona, the first approach to godliness as law, de-esh de-tzugam, le-limudam ha-kiyumam, to learn the laws, to keep the laws, hu-kabalato l'avodat eved, is with acceptance of the yoke and the service of a slave. U-biya nosaf, and a further explanation, the kevan she'ikai inyan avdut hu be'evet kanani. In fact, the real concept of being a slave is not the Hebrew slave, but the Canaanite slave. And he gives in brackets various things about the difference between the Hebrew slave and the Canaanite slave. So 2.5 lines from the end, hare bichdei l'ramez inyan anal, in order to indicate the idea that through keeping mitzvot, we should be in a way of a slave. It should have. We would have thought it would begin with an Eved Kanani. Why does it with a Canaanite slave? Why does it begin with a Hebrew slave? Okay, so one of the initial questions was, why begin with a slave? And it's explained. The reason why it begins with a slave is because our relationship with God, even when we're dealing with rational laws, should be with the irrationality, the super-rationality, the law beyond reason, like a slave has to obey his master without question.
And we should do this for 6 years and that's it.
Interesting.
Like an Eved Ivri.
Yeah, then you... you may, as you said before, or someone suggested before, Julius, that you move to a higher level.
You become a Canaanite.
But this paragraph is ended with a question. Using this sort of rationale, we can understand why it begins with an idea of a slave. But why with a Hebrew slave? It would have made more sense to begin with a Canaanite slave to understand the whole idea of the subjugation to God. Now, it's going to end off, whether we'll get there or not, because it is getting late. It's going to end off that the difference between the Hebrew slave and the Canaanite slave, as I tried to explain before, the Canaanite slave doesn't want to do anything. Avdo behefkeira nichale. A slave likes doing nothing. Like the workers in a certain country, which will be nameless, where it takes four men, talking of pits in the road, it takes four men to dig a pit. One to dig and three to watch him dig. So the Canaanite slave doesn't want to work, but he does because he's beaten with a stick, which is the divine soul prodding him. Come on, do it. The put a mezuzah on the door, eat kosher. Put on tefillin, light a Shabbos candle. The divine soul energizing the person. And then the Hebrew slave actually wants to do. The desire of the Hebrew slave is to do spiritual things. That's what he enjoys. He doesn't want to. He finds it very peculiar to sit doing nothing. A friend of mine. So my friend was extremely hyperactive, and he would come home as like a teenager, and his father, who like worked very, very hard during the day, his father would just be sitting in a chair, and my friend could not stand that his father should just be sitting in the chair. How can you just be sitting in the chair? Do something. So the poor father used to hold a newspaper. The father told me this. He would hold a newspaper in front of his eyes so that his son would think he's reading the newspaper, but really he wasn't. He was just pretending, because really he was exhausted and he just wanted to sit still. But the hyperactive son, you know, couldn't bear the idea of just sitting still. You've got to be doing something. Unfortunately, both are now in the other world. But, So that's the Hebrew slave. The Hebrew slave wants to do things. He wants to do good things. And so therefore the Hebrew slave really enjoys the whole idea of Torah and mitzvot and whatever dimension it is. He wants to do it. He's thirsty to do it. Tzomer l'chol nafshi, my soul thirsts for you. That's the Hebrew slave. The Hebrew slave is on a spiritual level. Not yet a tzaddik. Not to the point of the Omer Ivriya, the maidservant. She is absolutely beyond. You know, that's something different. But even the Hebrew slave is at a very, very, very spiritual. So that's why it's beginning with the Hebrew slave telling us that's what we should be reaching towards, at least first base. Okay, let's go a little bit further. This is where we're going to come to this diagram, hopefully. The Yuvan, and we can understand this Bahakdim Rasal by first exploring the Drasha, the teaching of the sages, which is in the Talmud in Erevin, on the verse Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneim, on this verse Dimizeshinem Asher Tasim Lifneim. The fact it says you should put it before them, Velo Asher Telamden. It doesn't say what you should teach them. It uses a different word. Lemeidim she'ein maspik sharav shonel etalmidav. This is what Rashi quotes in the Chumash. It's not enough that the rabbi should teach his students again and again halachot kama pamim. He should say them several times over. Ad she'yu sedurim b'fiyem, till they know them by heart. That's not enough. Eile tzarich gam lesum lifneim tam amiyashev talmudam. He has to give them reasons which makes their learning make sense. miyashev, makes it settle in a proper way. V'alpiza yishlama, so from this we can say, demasha katov lachazeki tikne. The fact that it says tikne in the singular, in the singular and in the second person, you, when you buy, hulelamez, it's to hint, dechis tikne kai gama lashet tasim. This is also talking about the process of teaching. Shaharav tsarich leshanot letalmidov ba'ofan, the teacher has to teach his pupils in such a way, she'inyan ha'nilmad yeh ha'kinyan shelahem, that what he's teaching them should be their acquisition. This is a very, very important concept, actually, in educational theory. Don't you recognize this? This idea that whatever the student is learning, they have to feel empowered over that. It's not enough that they are able to do this, work out the equation in chemistry or something. They have to actually be the master of it. It has to be theirs in some sense. And that's why one goes to such great lengths, showing them experiments and that it's all or a film, so that there's a reality to the subject that they're studying. So even though there may be bright students who could carry out the function without all of that, what you're trying to do is impart the knowledge so that it's internalized and it becomes the possession of the student. As the saying of the sages on the verse. Now here we have this key verse, which is a verse at the very beginning of the book of Psalms. B'torat Hashem cheftzo, his desire is the Torah of God, uvatorato, and on his Torah, yehege yomam v'layla, he meditates day and night. And the comment of the sages is, shebitchila nikret haTorah shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at the beginning the Torah is called God's Torah. And after that, nikret haShmo, it's called his Torah. Torato. The fact that the Torah becomes the possession of the person studying Torah, is when he knows the reasons for the law. That's the big virtue of studying Talmud. That the person understands when they're studying Talmud, they understand which verse it comes from, and that there was a machloket Tanayim about this, and that it's the resolution of that machloket is this way, but there are still dubious things, and then the poskim come, and one says this, and one says that, and finally it's paskin for halacha in this way. They're able to see the whole rationale of the halachic process. And when a person sees that, they have a different relationship with that law. It's not just a law. In fact, I discussed this in an article once. The difference between, like, the simple statement of the, let's say, the brief code of law, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, says you should do this and this. Now, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the brief code of law, is a very, very important document, because it sets a standard, what is proper observance of the Torah. And it was written in around 1850 by Reb Shlomo Gansfried, but it's a key work of bringing Torah observance into the modern world. In fact, I know a friend of mine, he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, it was a young woman. Young woman went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, she said, what kind of husband should I look for? The Rebbe said, someone who knows very well the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the brief Shulchan Aruch. So she goes out with this boy, young man from the yeshiva, on the shidduch, and she keeps asking him questions from the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And as it happens, he knew that very well, and he was giving answers. So she marries him. And thank God they've been married many, many years, and have lovely children, thank God. But he later found out why she kept testing him on his knowledge of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. But I'm sure it stood him in very good stead. So, but the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is just saying what the law is. Now, if you look at Rabbi Shneur Zalman's code of law, the Kitzur was written, the brief code of law was written in 1850 in order to summarize the halacha. He took three guides to help him decide what is the brief law he's going to state. So one was from a great Hasidic leader, Rabbi Shneur Zalman. One was someone in the Lithuanian tradition, the Chai Adam, Rabbi Danziger. And the third was a book which was like, often in a big siddur, there would be like a set of halachot for daily life, written by a very, very learned person, and he took that also as his, so there were these three, points of input into the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Now, when you look at Rabbi Shneur Zalman's code of law, you get a whole, it's not just stating what the law is. It says that some people thought that, and some people thought this, and then there was a discussion, and then it was resolved that you should do it in this and this way, but on the other hand, some people would do it in that way. Like, it gives you a very, it's not black and white. There's lots of shades and variegation, and you're able to look at the sources. Now there's a modern edition of the Rabbi Shneur Zalman's Code of Law, where it traces through the sources of what he said, and this is extremely popular. Outside, nothing to do with Chabad as such, but in terms of where it started, because it's very, very good analysis of the whole halachic process going back through the generations. So it's the new edition that you need in order to follow this up. Just to take one paragraph and to follow that through the sources in the Talmud and in the Rosh and in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch and in the Magen Avraham and all, it's Gan Eden in this world. Olam Haba in this world. So in order to so once you've learned, let's say you've taken one paragraph, you know, who knows, that people know the whole thing, but you've taken one paragraph, you've explored it in this way, like Birkat HaChama, yes, that whole concept, and you examine all the different halachot this way and that way and what it says in the mystical literature, and so you've acquired this in, it's become yours. So it's through the rational process that it becomes Torato, the Torah of the person. V'zeu asher tasim lifneim ki tikne. That's why it's, you put it before the people. Moshe should teach the people. How do you teach them? In such a way, ki tikne, in such a way that each one of them as an individual acquires the Torah, that it's his or her own Torah that he or she has learned as a kinyan, as something that they have acquired for themselves. Now, I think we're reaching the limit of time, but what it explains in the next paragraph is that the juxtaposition of these two concepts, the Torah Hashem, the infinite, supernal law beyond reason, and the Torah Tor, the Torah of the person, which is rational, which is understood, in order to get those two together is through the power of Ein Sof, which is beyond. And at a later point in the discourse, it explains how Ein Sof is drawn into the picture. It's through Moshe. In other words, the power of Moshe, who is teaching the law to the people, is to be able to bond together that which is beyond reason with that which is within reason. And that's really what he's giving the Jewish people. He's giving the Jewish people the ability to appreciate that. And then the discourse goes on to say that not only is the infinite important in enabling this process to take place, in fact, this process expresses a revelation of the infinite in a remarkable way that wouldn't be possible otherwise, through the fact that the Torah Hashem, the law of Hashem, which is beyond reason, becomes the personal kinyan of the Torah of the individual. That action, and that is enabled through the power of Ein Sof, the infinite, that itself becomes an expression of the infinite. And so therefore, in the Torah that one studies, and that whole appreciation of the Torah, together with realizing the bitul, the selflessness, and the exalted quality of the Torah, that is a gilui of Or Ein Sof Baruch Hu, the radiance of the infinite. So this discourse also emphasizes, like the discourse we learned last week, the way in which in the study of Torah there is a continuous interaction with the divine in a very, very intense way. And it is sweeter than honey. And all one can say is as you mentioned before, with a laptop, you can spend your whole life just getting this piece of Torah, that piece. You know what? You don't need a laptop. You can have a book. And Baruch Hashem, books are available, and just to explore with the help of Hashem. Okay.
Explains the conundrum of the state of Israel. And its people.
Well, yes. I think the fact that we're all a combination of reason and beyond reason explains many things.